He went, "You paying yourself properly yet?" And I was like, "What?" He goes, "You paying yourself properly yet?" I'm like, "Oh, well, I don't know. What do you consider like 60 grand? And he's like, "Nah." He goes, "Pay yourself properly."
Okay.
And so suddenly you're like, "Okay, permission granted, I guess."
Mark, welcome to the show. You run a business called ScreenCloud. Tell me about it.
Thank you for having me. So ScreenCloud is a B2B SaaS platform for digital signage. So digital signage is handling networks of screens on behalf of customers. Most people know that as like outdoor advertising, what you might see in Times Square, Piccadilly Circus, the airport, or McDonald's screens, things like that. We tend to focus on screens as a communication platform, but we handle many, many screens for our customers and help them get content up there in front of their audience.
Amazing, amazing. So how do you acquire customers?
Well, historically, we've had a mostly inbound acquisition model. So in the early days, we did a lot of work around content, specifically kind of SEO and blog content, also video. And so people who are out there looking for digital signage, but maybe didn't understand that category term, it's not a very well-known term, but they might have been things, you know, Googling, you know, how to put my menu board on a screen, and we would come up there. So we kind of built quite a good top of funnel that way. And then we also are well ranked on, you know, software review sites like G2 and Captera. So people who are in market and looking for that kind of solution usually will come across us. But we're beginning to move more to like an account-based marketing model as we move more towards enterprise.
Amazing. So if I'm at the gym and I have an advert on the screen whilst I'm on the treadmill, that's you.
Potentially. That would have been probably more likely to have been us a few years back. We still do that. In fact, actually, I just recently did do a gym customer here in London, kind of high-end gym. So potentially that would be us. You know, now you're thinking about digital signage, you're going to see screens everywhere and think, oh, is that ScreenCloud? And because quite often I actually do go into a venue and I can tell it's our software running, which is quite cool. We always take a snap of it and share it back in Slack to the team. It's quite cool seeing your product in the real world.
So yeah, you started the business 7 or 8 years ago. When was that first time that you saw your own screen, your own work in person, and like, how did that make you feel?
As a surprise?
Well, yeah, just like walking down the street or walking into an office building, you kind of maybe didn't realize that it was going to be there. And then,
you know, a good anecdote on that one, I was giving a talk actually at a school. A friend of mine was the head of sixth form there, and he wanted like an entrepreneur to come in and speak to the graduating class about kind of their journey, so they could kind of hear an alternative career point. So I went down and, you know, it was really just a favor, just kind of going talking to these young adults, really. And then we went in, and I was like, oh, the screen looks pretty familiar. And then we were talking to the receptionist on front desk, and she was like, oh yeah, we use this platform called ScreenCloud, it's really good. And I was like, well, that's quite cool. So yeah, it makes you feel great. Like, yeah. I mean, when you see your product in the real world, you know, actually adding value and you're looking good, thankfully, there was no bugs or errors, then it's pretty cool.
Are you a 6 a.m. or an 8 a.m. person?
Depends. Actually, to be honest, I say I'm more of an 8 a.m. person, but now I have a one-year-old, very energetic dog. I am a 6 a.m. person every day to feed him, take him out. So I'm reluctantly a 6 a.m. person.
Off screen, when we spoke, you said that you would never run a business when you were younger in the teenage years.
That's right, yeah.
Today, you run a very successful business. Mm-hmm. What's changed?
I think I was in denial of my DNA. Like entrepreneurship, I think, you know, runs in my family. Both my mum and dad ran a business independently and then together. And I lived through the ups and downs, which is kind of probably what put me off when I was younger and probably a bit more fearful. But the reality is, like, I was built to do this. This is, yeah, you know, I didn't really excel in corporate life. Someone with my kind of strengths and weaknesses is much more suited to building companies.
I mean, you tried your hand at corporate life. You worked for PwC, you then moved to an agency. You then left that agency and effectively set up a competitor, carbon copied it. Would you recommend that to any entrepreneur in terms of if they're going to start their journey?
Absolutely, yeah, good question. I think that often when people are just starting, especially if you're younger, like I was 23 then, didn't have a huge amount of experience. I think actually just taking what you've already learned and just doing that for yourself, whether it's a consultancy thing, you don't need to have the home run straight away. In fact, it's quite unlikely that you will, because there's so much to learn. So you may as well do something you're already good and competent at, that you might even have a small network of existing clients and other people you've worked with. So you want to keep what you're doing every day as consistent as what you previously were doing, but just now it's for yourself, and you're going to go through a huge learning curve, and then you can always evolve that over time, which is exactly what will happen with us.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't need the 1% idea straight away, right?
You just now every single thing in your life is new. So, you know, is that like, if you just do the basic odds of success, you know, you're just creating extra friction. Whereas at least if like only 50% is brand new, like how do I do PAYE, or like, you know, how do I set up a business bank account? All of these things that suddenly you now have to do. But if the other half is familiar and you already know you're pretty competent at that, I think your chances of success are much higher. And really it's all about kind of learning as quickly as you can.
Absolutely. You ran a business called Cogent for 18 years, a digital product studio. So building web apps, putting development teams into big corporates. You've worked with some amazing clients. Fully bootstrapped evangelist. You then fundraised for ScreenCloud. So you're an experienced entrepreneur at this point, never fundraised.
Yeah.
Talk me through that process.
So Cogent ultimately was a consultancy business, an agency business, and you don't raise funding for that, right? And people don't fund that kind of thing. Back then, and probably still even today, getting any kind of support from a bank when you've got zero revenue and zero track record, like they'll ask you, you know, to put quite a lot on the line for even a $5,000 overdraft. So you just don't have one. So everything you do, you've got to do out of cash flow. And that builds a really good kind of efficiency, kind of cash flow efficiency model, which funnily enough now in the startup game is now being really appreciated more recently. It wasn't always the case. But yeah, you know, when ScreenCloud was a business that was going to need a lot more upfront investment, like at least a year, maybe a year and a half of product development, and then relatively low amount of income coming, even when people did start to pay. So obviously, you know, people, the team needs to get paid, right? Even if it's not that much. So yeah, I had to kind of go and, like, from being somewhat experienced in certain things to being completely novice in fundraising. And that was like an enormous learning curve, quite scary, a lot of pressure, because you know that if you don't succeed in raising that funds, then this great team, this great idea is never going to happen. So yeah, it's quite a lot of pressure, but I guess it was the pressure that kind of pushed me through that. But yeah, I learned a lot from doing that.
Talk me through the first pitch that you did to investors for ScreenCloud.
Yeah, so I had a couple of friendly contacts who committed to some investment, but there was still quite a lot of money outstanding that we needed to do. So I needed to go to people who didn't know me. At the time, I'm not sure if it's still the case today. I'm not completely up to date, but like, this is 2015. I found that there were these like network groups of angels, and they would have these events, like pitch events, and you could apply to that. And if you were successful, you'd be like one of five or even 10 companies pitching to these angels, and then hopefully getting introductions and stuff. So the first one I got, they basically got me on stage. They were quite prescriptive in how it worked. Like, they wanted you to wear a suit, very, very tight on like what you could and couldn't say. So already like that was quite bad. And then basically I had like really low confidence in myself to pitch. So I had notes, which I was reading out. And I don't think my pitch was exactly very convincing, even though the content I think was all right. So of the 400 angels in the room, it's also pretty stressful, right? 400 people in a room with these kind of powerful business people, basically absolutely no one. Well, one person did show some interest, but actually he just wanted to take me on a date, which was kind of awkward. So 400 people completely just did the thumbs down on that one. And I think it was all in my lack of confidence that I was oozing about the company because of my own, you know, inhibitions.
I think it's crazy, isn't it? Because you look to it now and it's a 21 million ARR business.
Yeah.
Back then you had worked with many Fortune 500 companies, you know, the top 10s, household names, an experienced CEO for 17, 18, 19 years. And you're nervous going into this first pitch.
Petrified, yeah.
What was your takeaways from pitch one to pitch two, and what did you tangibly do?
Yeah, so I suppose I was fortunate in one case, in many ways to fail that badly is quite good because you know that you must respond. Like if I maybe had like 20 meetings but none of them had come off, then maybe I wouldn't have radically altered what I'd done. But the reality is, you know, basically at a zero response rate. What I did also see is other entrepreneurs who are more experienced in this game pitching, to be honest, what I think was actually kind of inferior businesses, but pitching with way, way, way more confidence and way more, it was way more convincing than what I was. And so I got to see what good looked like. And then I realized that, so I had another pitch event 2 weeks later and it was gonna be the last one before the summer break. So it was kind of like fairly urgent. I kind of like mimicked that impressive behavior, that sort of that gusto and confidence that I could see in them. And actually, you know, to your point, like my credentials were pretty strong, but my pitch was so bad, I think no one really believed it. So I kind of like reinvented myself in those 2 weeks just with like a hell of a lot of practice, you know, just saying over and over and over again, no notes. I asked to go first on the next pitch so I could kind of just go in and like just bang it out there. And in that pitch, I managed to get like 10 angels who all agreed to invest subsequently and have been really supportive on our journey. And so it was kind of like, you know, zero to done in like 2 weeks, just with a flip of like, I just wasn't the right level. But it's not that hard to get to that level. You've just got to believe in yourself and you've got to practice hard.
And you got investment from those angels.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was all done Amazing. And dusted, you know, and some of those angels, you know, they were really quite like high net worth individuals, have continued to support ScreenCloud in subsequent rounds. And when we had tough times, like in COVID, where like no VCs wanted to talk to me then, because like everything got shut where my customers are pretty much. Those angels who we'd had a good relationship with, they backed us then when we were on our knees, you know, so actually subsequently it's proven to be a very, very important moment in my life.
A very important 2 weeks for you to train your sort of pitch to a better place.
And I suppose like, you know, at that point I knew I could do public speaking, you know, because if you can do that, right, you can, then you can go on stage and do industry events and, you know, so it unlocked a whole part of my personality, which I didn't think existed.
Well, I think that's it, right? You, for 17, 18 years, you'd been a salesperson for your business. You'd been the main salesperson for your business. You'd closed extremely high net worth deals in a closed sort of small room. So natural step, you'd be like, oh, Mark has got this in the bag. But it was quite far from the truth until you worked on it.
Yeah. I mean, I should say, obviously, like, you know, my co-founders were big on the sales. So we never sold as individuals on the agency. Like, I would never have been able to get where I got without David. So just to mention that, I don't want to take credit where it's not due. So sales was like a real team effort, and very rarely was I pitching to anyone more than like 3-5 people. Suddenly being on a stage, you know, to hundreds, it's a step change, it's totally different. And it goes back to all of those inhibitions that you might have even had right from like really early on in life about those insecurities. You know, they come out, they rear their ugly head, you know, in moments of quite high stress. And I think public speaking is sort of up there as like one of the higher stress things. But once you know that you can do it and you know that it's gonna be okay, I mean, it's a superpower, you know, for communication, but most people don't want to do it. But you've got to get over that hump.
You've hired many people over the years. You're up to around 125 at ScreenCloud now. Where have you found the best talent and top tips for hiring?
The memories of the people where, you know, we've identified someone who's pretty early career, like kind of probably fairly new into the work industry at all, but they've just got the right qualities. And then we've just seen them flourish. You know, one, you probably mentored those people fairly closely, me and others, you know, it's not like Luke's mentored the developers and stuff like that. But, you know, and they, it's just really fulfilling to see like how good they get, how quickly they get. And that has always been, you know, so I suppose identifying raw talent, I suppose, has been something I'm quite proud of. These days, as we've got bigger, like we don't really have the capacity to do that as much anymore because it is intensive for the person who's like doing the mentorship and stuff. But in the early days, it's an amazing trade because, you know, you're developing them, but they're also, I mean, more affordable. The reality is like really experienced people don't join very early stage companies. One, because the salary is not very good, and two, the risk is high. So, you know, you kind of need to do this anyway, but it's really, you know, it really builds a strong culture. So yeah, I'm kind of romantic to like those sort of things. And in terms of finding people, I guess usually it's through network. Back in the days pre-Brexit, we had relationships with, you know, technical and design colleges in Europe, like in the Netherlands, Belgium, France, and you know, everyone, all of those, you know, kind of guys wanted to come and live in London, and you know, it was just for them, it was the dream.
Yeah.
And you know, they might not have had like really strong English at the time, although that got sorted out pretty quickly. But they had this hunger and talent, and you know, these really strong educational backgrounds. So. Yeah, that was really cool. That was kind of my favorite memories. And we don't get to do enough of it anymore, unfortunately.
So you're 125 members of your team now. What's your top tips for hiring?
Okay, top tips for hiring. I mean, I've made quite a few hiring mistakes as well over the time. And actually, I think you know, hiring gets more difficult when you start bringing in really experienced people. It's actually much harder to judge the difference between the great people and the not so great people. And what I've found is that, you know, just because they've got great logos on their CV, this is kind of fairly well known, but, you know, it might not have been them that maybe went on that crazy rip, you know, when this company was exploding. They might have just been kind of along for the ride. So you've got to really dive in and not be like too impressed, you know, by the big job title, by the big salary, or you know, the big logos. Right, you got to get in and be like, is this the right person for me today?
You're in your eighth year of building ScreenCloud now. Mm-hmm. You're doing £21 million ARR.
There's $8, yeah.
$21 million yeah, dollars. US dollars.
Yeah.
ARR.
Because we're mostly focused on America, so we do everything in dollars.
Got you. Very impressive.
Thank you.
What's next?
More growth, unrelenting growth. So it's interesting. So I think around the 20 million mark, I mean, maybe a bit earlier, depends on what's going on, right? Because a lot of our, you know, we were affected by COVID. So I'd say we probably were a little bit later coming to this scale up stage because it wasn't really appropriate in COVID, wasn't really possible. But that really is where you have to shed this idea that you're a startup. You're not a startup anymore. And you need to reinvent yourself constantly, especially as a CEO. You've got to stay ahead of the business, or at least up to where the stage of the business is. And so I basically, if anyone says startup, I say, no, we're not a startup anymore. We're scale up, right? It's a different, scale up is still very different. We're not a mature corporate business by any stretch, but if you have to start to adopt what you are or what you're about to become. Otherwise, like if you don't manifest that correctly, you'll just keep doing more of what worked in the past. And actually that will become something that sort of actually becomes a burden on the business, right? So you've got to put a bit more structure in, got to have a bit more process, kind of go through the org chart. Like as a CEO, you've got to resist kind of, you know, so it's a fine line. Like you still can't lose all of your natural instincts for shooting from the hip and stuff like that. But maybe you do become a bit more data driven, a bit more process oriented. It's a bit of a balance that. But yeah, so what's next, I guess, is really fleshing out what that scale up version looks like without losing our velocity, our creativity, you know, our product focus, our customer centricity, all of those kind of things. And then increasingly, you know, going from like 20 million to 50 million ARR, you know, the reality is like you need new channels to market. Like that's where partnership starts to become a thing, strategic partnerships. You're also probably working with bigger enterprise clients, maybe with larger annual contract values. And that's where you're getting more into the world of like, you know, legal contract negotiation, MSAs, procurement teams, extended sales cycles. You know, it's a really different game. But it's still an exciting and interesting game. But yeah, I think getting fit and ready for that, and embracing that, and sort of putting the past as fond memories as they are in that memory box and be like, those days are over. We're new now. And you've got to push that through the culture. And not everyone wants that.
Yeah.
It's difficult.
Yeah, 100%. Let's deep dive into a topic.
Cool.
Topic around money. It's always a good topic. When should you, as a CEO of a business, start paying yourself good money? Now, good money means different things to different people, of course. But if you talk to me about when you sort of took that step up in your personal take home, because it's very romanticized entrepreneurship, and especially with the pay that you can take home. I'm sure now you're doing very well, $21 million ARR. You're probably paying yourself a lot more than when you were just starting out CodeGem.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, with Cogent, I mean, when there's zero in the bank, you're being paid zero. Like, I mean, you can't shake the magic money tree. So I had to have a second job then just to pay the bills, you know. I think it's a really difficult one. I think I'll probably put it into like maybe three buckets of like the early days where really, where you literally have no choice. You can't pay yourself money, or you've got to pay yourself a really, really minimal amount. Then maybe, I suppose, this kind of tricky middle area where there's money there, but like, should it really be going to you?
How much you should take?
Yeah, should you be just constantly reinvesting and stuff like that? And then I suppose that as you kind of mature, then it gets towards like paying yourself a proper market rate and things like that. Now, there's a lot of different opinions about this, and I think in America it's different as well. Like some people are like, you know, I mean, there are second-time CEOs who just pay themselves zero, you know, and just like, well, I've got this equity, you know, the equity. But I kind of think with the equity thing is like, okay, I mean, that is an easy thing to hit people with. But like, you know, I'm almost nine years into ScreenCloud. You know, previously to that, like, started my other business in 2003. Like, I mean, I've never really had a really big equity win yet. I mean, I've taken zero out of ScreenCloud so far. So that's 20 odd years, you know. At one point it's like, you know, you want to have a family. I'm like, I'm in my mid 40s, you know, and it's an easy one to go, oh yeah, but one day, you know, it's like, no. I think the journey, you shouldn't suffer unjustly on the journey, but I think you need to be responsible. So at the beginning, you don't have a choice. So that's a kind of an easy answer. Like, hey, you have any money anyway, so do it.
I think for me, it's very much around like runway of the business, putting enough in the bank account. Like, for example, for me, when I was building Airbyte, we were very frugal of what we spent on us as co-founders.
I think that is right.
But it does get to a point where you kind of go, well, actually, I would like to live a little bit better.
Well, also, it's a stress test of the actual business, because like the business isn't real if the people inside it aren't getting paid properly to do it. Like, it's kind of like a false economy. If you sold that business and left, they would have to hire people in your position. They presumably have to hire them for more than fuck all, right? Yeah. So suddenly that business would be a massive, it might just blow up. And so therefore it's not really real. So I think, you know, like you should be constantly optimizing towards the business. But there is a point where you're either default alive, you know, or like this business is now sustainable enough. And then actually, it's irresponsible not to be paying people the market rate, because you are then basically building into the fabric of the business a false economy, which if you are to ever sell this asset, someone very quickly is going to realize, well, if I need to replace that CEO, I need to 10x that salary, then this is no longer viable. So the business needs to, when it can, support a really commercially viable market rate infrastructure. I don't think you should milk the cow too much, because, you know, because there is this equity that one day might be worth something. But, you know, so long as you, I suppose, like, the way I look at it, as long as you can look yourself in the mirror and be like if this was just like public now, I'd be happy with this. I could justify this. Then I think that's fine.
Yeah, I think it's different as well for types of business. Like, we've both run agencies before. You now run a tech business. I think it's very different. So, for me, one of the biggest triggers around paying myself a salary was runway.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
How much runway we had. So for me, it was always a minimum of 6 months, which a number of peers went, you're bloody crazy for such a large runway, because it's just so hard to get to that.
Yeah.
For
yeah,
me,
yeah.
That was always, I want to be able to go no contracts 4-6 months? What's your opinion on runways, and has it changed between agency to tech business?
Great question. At Cogent, we way over optimized on runway, even to a point I'd say like it wasn't even just runway, it was like a rainy day fund. I mean, at one point I think we had almost like £1 million in the bank, like, you know, there, but we weren't giving it to ourselves. We did use it to actually invest in our own product, so I suppose that was wise because it was beyond runway at that point, right? Like, and actually, to be honest, if you bled through all of that money on runway, then really, you know, you should have probably taken some bigger action earlier. So there is a point about, like, you know, if you're bleeding yourself dry on a long runway, like, are you really facing up to the challenges in your business? The reality with all of these questions is that the decisions you make today will only truly be judged by what happens next, and that might be slightly out of your control. So if, for example, it turned out, like in Cogent's case, that runway was excessive in the future, then you look back at it and go, kind of should have probably were a bit conservative there. But, you know, had there been yet another financial crisis like the one we went through in 2008, maybe we'd be like patting ourselves on the back going, yeah, good choice there. Look at all the people who sailed too close to the wind. So, you know, it's tricky because you don't know really what's going to happen. And unfortunately, like, you might have made a reasonably sensible decision at the time. And I think that's what you should hold on to. Like, at the time with the information I had, did this feel like the right thing to do? If honestly so, then that's fine. And then unfortunately, like, the story will really be told by events which are mostly out of your control.
Yeah, I mean, it's hindsight. Hindsight is an amazing thing. But what about situations where you were like, damn, I'm grateful for that rainy day fund?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, well, like 2008 would be a good example of that. And even that, we kind of got a bit depleted because unbelievably an accountant stole some money from us, which was like, I mean, that's an unforeseen
so
moment.
Not just a financial crisis, internal and external financial crisis.
Yeah. And I'm very, very sadly, as a result of that, we had to make a couple of people redundant. That was the first time we had to do that, which was really... to make someone redundant for like genuinely external factors and something as selfish as theft from a small company where...
How big were you at the time?
Yeah, we're probably about 25 people. And obviously she knew what our cash position was, clearly.
Yeah.
But would have known that would have hurt.
And you have to let go like 10% of the workforce or...
Yeah, it wasn't quite that, but it was like, but it was heart-wrenching. And just like, really just fucking out of order, basically. So yeah, like, you know, like there were different times where that rainy day fund was useful. In that case, it wasn't quite enough. It built up, it did allow us to invest in our own ideas without the pressure of, say, investors, which I think is why ScreenCloud probably has been more successful, because we were off to a better start. And I've subsequently done a bit of angel investing, and I've seen how long it takes for other people with, you know, we didn't really have to do pivots. We're pretty strong on products, so we kind of get product market fit quite quickly, because to be honest, the BBC, Nestle, all these people we used to work for, they don't let you have three bites of the cherry on a project. You've got to get it right first time. So I think we probably were quite good at that. But I've seen with others, like, it does take them a while to get going and actually having the pressure of investors saying, you know, when are we going to start seeing more revenue? Like, that maybe possibly makes some poor decision making, like optimizing for the short term, not the long. So yeah.
So second time around, CEO pay, director team, pay, redundancies, anything like that in terms of runway and sort of how much you should be paying yourself as a CEO?
So I suppose when we had investors, then suddenly you have to justify your salary expectations to third parties, which I never had to do before. And it's been a double-edged sword with that one. So at the beginning, investors hate to see you being paid too much because they're like, I'm investing money, not just to give you a salary to kind of like muck around for a couple of years. Like, I want to see that going into product, I want to see it going to marketing and all of these fine things. So to be honest, at the very beginning, you do need to go low. So we went back to like the minimum we could get to get by. But then I think you don't want to see someone suffering so much that they're spending half of the week thinking, how am I going to even like put a roof over my head or eat? Like, that's too much. So it was pretty low for a couple of years, and we started to kind of, you know, build up with him getting towards what, 1 million ARR or whatever, or even getting up towards that. Then it was like, right, let's switch it to something which is like modest but better, so you're not just scrabbling constantly. This is a couple of years in. Because again, you don't want to like completely burn people out. Yeah. It's a marathon, right? And you've got to get through that marathon. And especially if the founder's a bit older, like the chances are they do have some other responsibilities in their life. And it isn't, you know, selfishness or anything or entitlement. And then actually, I remember having a lunch with one of my angel investors, and he just sat down with me, and just, he's originally from Yorkshire, so he's quite straight talking. He just kind of went, you're paying yourself properly yet? And I was like, what? He goes, you're paying yourself properly yet? I'm like, well, I don't know. What do you consider like 60 grand? And he's like, nah. He goes, pay yourself properly.
Okay.
And so suddenly you're like, okay, permission granted, I guess. Yeah. And then, you know, you kind of like go towards probably the lower market rate for what you do. And then, yeah, I mean, I guess then as you get to scale up, I mean, I'm now, you know, there's quite a lot of people still in Screen Club paid more than me. You know, in the States and sales, just they get paid well. But, you know, if you're bringing in people who are, you are literally mentoring and managing and they're 50% more salary than you, yeah. And you think, oh, come on, that's just not right.
Yeah, it doesn't
make
sense.
Let's just not do this. You know? And then, as I said earlier, like, you know, the business needs to be a legit business, which means everyone in the right role needs to be paid market rate, or you're kind of faking it. Mm. And after 8 years in, like, you shouldn't be faking that anymore, right? This has to get real. So, in the big, you know, scheme of things, like my salary versus like what we're earning, what we're generating is still minuscule, really. Mm. So, yeah.
What's your opinion on dogs in co-working spaces or offices?
Ah, interesting. Well, as a dog owner, I always thought having a dog in the office is awesome. But I think in co-working spaces, I think in your own office, it's probably fine because you are fully in control. But we have to be respectful that not everyone is a dog person. Yeah. It's a bit of a distraction. And some people may be like, you know, even allergic to like, you know, fur and stuff, yeah, like that. So I think actually it's probably a no. And my second dog, Fergus, the one I've got now, like he's so like, he'll get bored or he'll just be really playful. And I think it's brilliant for have them visit. I don't think they should be there all the time. And it wasn't, funny enough, in a previous co-working space at Screen Cloud where I had my previous dog, Kanto, I thought about bringing him in and then I realized someone had a really bad allergy. Yeah. I was like, you know what? Like, that's not cool.
Yeah.
I suppose it's like if you're on a plane and someone's got like a horrific nut allergy, yeah, it's like you hear these people going, oh, I was like, were they really dreaming of salted nuts on this 2-hour EasyJet flight? It's like, look, if they're going to have to go to hospital as a, yeah, result of a nut, I'll just not have any nuts. You know.
100%. What's the luckiest you've ever been as a founder or entrepreneur?
Luck is as a result of just consistent positive effort and sharing that effort out. And I say to like early stage founders, I say like, does every single human in your life know what you're doing and what you're trying to achieve and what you want next? Like, you know, like if you're too shy to ask and you're too shy to tell, I was like, oh, I don't want to talk about me. I was like, well, no, you shouldn't be doing this. Like your job, a CEO especially, your job is to give this company the best chance of having a future. That means you need to talk about it. And the people who are most likely to want to help you are the people you've either met in person, your loved ones, your friends, their friends of friends, whatever that might be. And you need to like light 1,000 fires. And then suddenly what will look like luck was actually just really because you triggered something which triggered something. And then you just let the universe do the rest, right? Like, you know, so that is only a really good example, but I've got like hundreds of examples I could give you, but I think it's more interesting to talk about why did it even happen in the first place.
Mark, where can people find you?
Actually probably my main channel is LinkedIn. So on LinkedIn, because I feel that is the most appropriate channel for me to talk all about Screen Cloud and screens and what we're doing. I try and keep the content relatively interesting there. I don't post too much. Mainly I push like video content, either talk about product or make recordings of the talks that I do. So if you're interested in following on the journey of the business, or probably what I'll be talking about more about is the medium of screens. Screens is a communication platform, which I'm fascinated about. I think there's a lot that's not understood about communicating through that channel. That's where I'm going to be pushing it out. So as long as you're not just going to spam my inbox, which a lot of people do, connect with me on LinkedIn. Otherwise, you know, follow along on the Screen Cloud channels. My own personal social media channels, I really keep more for like people I know.
So LinkedIn, you're Mark McDermott, LinkedIn.
Yeah, my username is MH McDermott. Sorry, yeah, MH McDermott, or just like Mark McDermott or CEO ScreenCloud. You'll find me pretty easily, I think. And yeah, that's my main channel.
Awesome. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you. Cheers.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Everyday Founder. If you haven't already, like or subscribe wherever you are watching or listening to this episode. If you know of an incredible founder that story needs to be shared, then let me know who you would like to see next on The Everyday Founder via the comment section or messaging me on LinkedIn. These episodes are brought to you by Shake Content, your LinkedIn content agency. So please show them support on all socials so that we can keep bringing you amazing guests and sharing their stories on The Everyday Founder.